and although she surely suffered slightly with a virgin's fear, she wanted him too. He had no doubt of that. Each day they were touching each other and kissing more often and more intimately, and the air between them crackled with erotic energy. But why not do things right and proper since they were so close to the day? Why not go to their marriage bed as virgins? She is a virgin to everyone, he to her. That night, Travis dreamed that Nora and Einstein were lost in the desolate reaches of the Mojave. In the dream, he was for some reason legless, forced to search for them at an agonizingly slow crawl, which was bad because he knew that wherever they were under attack by something. Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday in Las Vegas, they prepared for the wedding, watched Einstein playing enthusiastically with other campers' dogs, and took side trips to Charleston Peak and Lake Mead. In the evenings, Nora and Travis left Einstein with his books while they went to stage shows. Travis felt guilty about leaving the retriever alone, but by various means Einstein indicated that he did not want them to stay at the trailer, merely because the strip hotels were so prejudiced and short-sighted as to refuse to allow well-behaved genius dogs into the casinos and showrooms. Wednesday morning, Travis dressed in a tuxedo, and Nora wore a simple calf-length white dress with spare lace trim at the cuffs and neckline. With Einstein between them, they drove to their wedding in the pickup, leaving the unhitched Airstream at the campgrounds. The non-denominational commercial chapel was the funniest place Travis had ever seen, for the design was earnestly romantic, solemn, and tacky, all at the same time. Nora thought it was hilarious, too, and upon entering they had trouble suppressing their laughter. The chapel was tucked in among neon-dripping, glitzy high-rise hotels on Las Vegas Boulevard South. It was only the size of a one-story house, pale pink stucco with white doors. Engraved in brass above the doors was the legend, "Ye shall go two by two." Instead of depicting religious images, the stained glass windows were aglow with garishly rendered scenes from famous love stories, including Romeo and Juliet, Abelard and Eloise, Aucassin and Nicolette, Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, and, unbelievably, I Love Lucy and Ozzie and Harriet. Curiously, the tackiness did not deflate their buoyant mood. Nothing could diminish this day. Even the outrageous chapel was to be prized, remembered in every gaudy detail to be vividly recalled over the years, and always to be recalled fondly, because it was their chapel on their day, and therefore special in its own strange way. Dogs were not ordinarily admitted, but Travis had generously tipped the entire staff in advance to ensure that Einstein would not only be allowed inside, but would be made to feel as welcome as anyone. The minister, the Reverend Dan Dupree, please call me Reverend Dan, was a florid-faced, pot-bellied fellow, a strenuous smiler and glad-hander who looked like a stereotypical used car salesman. He was flanked by two paid witnesses, his wife and her sister, who were wearing bright summery dresses for the occasion. Travis took his place at the front of the chapel. The woman organist struck up the wedding march. Nora had expressed a deep desire to actually walk down the aisle and meet Travis, rather than just beginning the ceremony at the altar railing. Furthermore, she wanted to be given away, as other brides were. That should have been her father's singular honor, of course, but she had no father. Nor was anyone else at hand who would be a likely candidate for the job, and at first it seemed that she would have to make the walk alone, or on the arm of a stranger. But in the pickup on their way to the ceremony, she had realized that Einstein was available, and she had decided that no one in the world was more suited to accompany her down the aisle than the dog. Now, as the organist played, Nora entered the back of the nave with the dog at her side. Einstein was acutely aware of the great honor of escorting her, and he walked with all the pride and dignity he could muster, his head held high, his slow steps timed to hers. No one seemed disturbed or even surprised that a dog was giving Nora away. This was, after all, Las Vegas. "She's one of the loveliest brides I've ever seen," Reverend Dan's wife whispered to Travis, and he sensed that she was sincere, that she did not routinely bestow that compliment. The photographer's flash blinked repeatedly, but Travis was too involved with the sight of Nora to be bothered by the strobe. Vases full of roses and carnations filled the small nave with their perfume, and 100 candles flickered softly, some in clear glass votive cups and others on brass candelabras. By the time Nora arrived at his side, Travis was oblivious of the tacky decor. His love was an architect that entirely remade the reality of the chapel, transforming it into a cathedral as grand as any in the world. The ceremony was brief and unexpectedly dignified. Travis and Nora exchanged vows, then rings. Tears full of reflected candlelight shimmered in their eyes, and Travis wondered for a moment why her tears should blur his vision, then realized that he, too, was on the verge of tears. A burst of dramatic organ music accompanied their first kiss as man and wife, and it was the sweetest kiss he had ever known. Reverend Dan popped the Dom Pérignon, and at Travis's direction poured a glass for everyone, the organist included. A saucer was found for Einstein. Slurping noisily, the retriever joined in their toast to life, happiness, and love eternal. Einstein spent the afternoon in the forward end of the trailer, in the living room, reading. Travis and Nora spent the afternoon at the other end of the trailer, in bed. After closing the bedroom door, Travis put a second bottle of Dom Pérignon in an ice bucket and loaded a compact disc player with 4 albums of George Winston's most mellow piano music. Nora drew down the blind at the only window and switched on a small lamp with a gold cloth shade. The soft amber light lent the room an aura rather like that of a place in a dream. For a while they lay on the bed, talking, laughing, touching, kissing, then talking less and kissing more. Gradually Travis undressed her. He'd never before seen her unclothed, and he found her even more lovely and more exquisitely proportioned than he had imagined. Her slender throat, the delicacy of her shoulders, the fullness of her breasts, the concavity of her belly, the flare of her hips, the round sauciness of her buttocks, the long, smooth, supple sleekness of her legs. Every line and angle and curve excited him, but also filled him with great tenderness. After he undressed himself, he patiently and gently introduced her to the art of love. With a profound desire to please, and with full awareness that everything was new to her, he showed Nora, sometimes not without delicious teasing, all the sensations that his tongue, fingers, and manhood could engender in her. He was prepared to find her hesitant, embarrassed, even fearful, because her first 30 years of life had not prepared her for this degree of intimacy. But she harbored no trace of frigidity, and was eager to engage in any act that might pleasure either or both of them. Her soft cries and breathless murmurs of excitement delighted him. Each time that she sighed climactically and surrendered to a shudder of ecstasy, Travis became more aroused, until he was of a size and firmness that he had never attained before, until his need was almost painful. When at last he let his warm seed flower within her, he buried his face in her throat and called her name and told her that he loved her, told her again and again. And the moment of release seemed so long that he half thought time had stopped, but that he had tapped an inexplicable well that could never be exhausted. With consummation achieved, they held each other for a long time, silent, not needing to talk. They listened to music, and in a while they finally spoke of what they felt, both physically and emotionally. They drank some champagne, and in time they made love again, and again. Although the constant shadow of certain death looms over every day, the pleasures and joys of life can be so fine and deeply affecting that the heart is nearly stilled by astonishment. From Vegas, they hauled the Airstream north on Route 95, across the immense Nevada Barrens. 2 days later, on Friday, August 13th, they reached Lake Tahoe and connected the trailer to the electric and water lines at an RV campsite on the California side of the border. Nora was not quite as easily overwhelmed by each new scenic vista and novel experience as she had been. However, Lake Tahoe was so stunningly beautiful that it filled her with childlike wonder again. 22 miles long and 12 miles wide, with the Sierra Nevadas on its western flank and the Carson Range in the east, Tahoe is said to be the clearest body of water in the world. A shimmering jewel, in 100 amazingly iridescent shades of blue and green. For 6 days, Nora and Travis and Einstein hiked in the El Dorado, Tahoe, and Toyabe National Forests, vast primeval tracts of pine, spruce, and fir. They rented a boat and went on the lake, exploring paradisiacal coves and graceful bays. They went sunning and swimming, and Einstein took to the water with the enthusiasms indigenous to his breed. Sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the late afternoon, more often at night, Nora and Travis made love. She was surprised by her carnal appetite. She could not get enough of him. "I love your mind and your heart," she told him. "But God help me, I love your body almost as much. Am I depraved?" "Good heavens, no. You're just a young, healthy woman. In fact, given the life you've led, you're emotionally healthier than you've any right to be. Really, Nora, you stagger me. I'd like to straddle you instead." "Maybe you are depraved," he said, and laughed. Early on the serenely blue morning of Friday, the 20th, they left Tahoe and drove across the state to the Monterey Peninsula. There, where the continental shelf met the sea, the natural beauty was, if possible, even greater than that at Tahoe, and they stayed 4 days, leaving for home on the afternoon of Wednesday, August 25th. Throughout their trip, the joy of matrimony was so all-consuming that the miracle of Einstein's human-like intelligence did not occupy their thoughts as much as previously. But Einstein reminded them of his unique nature when they drew near to Santa Barbara late that afternoon. 40 or 50 miles from home, he grew restless. He shifted repeatedly on the seat between Nora and Travis, sat up for a minute, then laid his head on Nora's lap, then sat up again. He began to whimper strangely. By the time they were 10 miles from home, he was shivering. "What's wrong with you, Furface?" she asked. With his expressive brown eyes, Einstein tried hard to convey a complex and important message, but she could not understand him. Half an hour before dusk, when they reached the city and departed the freeway for surface streets, Einstein began alternately to whine and growl low in his throat. "What's wrong with him?" Nora asked. Frowning, Travis said, "I don't know." As they pulled into the driveway of Travis's rented house and parked in the shade of the date palm, the retriever began to bark. He had never barked in the truck, not once on their long journey. It was ear-splitting in that confined space, but he would not stop. When they got out of the truck, Einstein bolted past them, positioned himself between them and the house, and continued barking. Nora moved along the walkway toward the front door, and Einstein darted at her, snarling. He seized one leg of her jeans and tried to pull her off balance. She managed to stay on her feet, and when she retreated to the birdbath, he let go of her. "What's gotten into him?" she asked Travis. Staring thoughtfully at the house, Travis said, "It was like this in the woods that first day, when he didn't want me to follow the dark trail." Nora tried to coax the dog closer in order to pet him, but Einstein would not be coaxed. When Travis tested the dog by approaching the house, Einstein snarled and forced him to retreat. "Wait here," Travis told Nora. He walked to the Airstream in the driveway and went inside. Einstein trotted back and forth in front of the house, looking up at the door and windows, growling and whining. As the sun rolled down the western sky and kissed the surface of the sea, the residential street was quiet, peaceful, ordinary in every respect. Yet Nora felt a wrongness in the air. A warm wind off the Pacific elicited whispers from the palm and eucalyptus and ficus trees, sounds that might have been pleasant any other day, but which now seemed sinister. In the lengthening shadows, in the last orange and purple light of the day, she also perceived an identifiable menace. Except for the dog's behavior, she had no reason to think that danger was near at hand. Her uneasiness was not intellectual, but instinctual. When Travis returned from the trailer, he was carrying a large revolver. It had been in a bedroom drawer, unloaded, throughout their honeymoon trip. Now Travis finished inserting cartridges into the chambers and snapped the cylinder shut. "Is that necessary?" she asked worriedly. "Something was in the woods that day," Travis said. "And though I never actually saw it, well, it put the hair up on the back of my neck. Yeah, I think the gun might be necessary." Her own reaction to the whispering trees and afternoon shadows gave her a hint of what Travis must have felt in the woods, and she had to admit that the gun made her feel at least slightly better. Einstein had stopped pacing and had taken up his guard position on the walkway again, barring their approach to the house. To the retriever, Travis said, "Is someone inside?" A quick wag of the tail. "Yes." "Men from the lab?" One bark. "No." "The other experimental animal you told us about?" "Yes." "The thing that was in the woods?" "Yes." "All right, I'm going in there." "No." "Yes," Travis insisted. "It's my house, and we're not going to run from this, whatever the hell it is." Nora remembered the magazine photograph of the movie monster to which Einstein had reacted so strongly. She did not believe anything, even remotely like that creature, could actually exist. She believed that Einstein was exaggerating, or that they had misunderstood what he'd been trying to tell them about the photo. Nevertheless, she suddenly wished they had not only the revolver, but a shotgun. "This is a .357 Magnum," Travis told the dog, "and one shot, even if it hits an arm or a leg, will knock down the biggest, meanest man and keep him down. He'll feel as if he's been hit by a cannonball. I've taken firearms training from the best, and I've done regular target practice over the years to keep my edge. I really know what I'm doing, and I'll be able to handle myself in there. Besides, we can't just call the cops, can we? Because whatever they find in there is going to raise eyebrows, lead to a lot of questions, and sooner or later they'll have you back in that damn lab again." Einstein was clearly unhappy with Travis's determination, but the dog padded up the front steps to the stoop and looked back as if to say, "All right, okay, but I'm not letting you go in there alone." Nora wanted to go in with them, but Travis was adamant that she remain in the front yard. She reluctantly admitted that since she lacked both a weapon and the skill to use it, there was nothing she could do to help, and that she would most likely only get in the way. Holding the revolver at his side, Travis joined Einstein on the stoop and inserted his key in the door. Part 7. Travis disengaged the lock, pocketed the key, and pushed the door inward, covering the room beyond with the .357. Warily, he stepped across the threshold, and Einstein entered at his side. The house was silent, as it should have been, but the air reeked of a bad smell that did not belong. Einstein growled softly. Little of the fast-fading sunlight entered the house through the windows, many of which were partly or entirely covered with drapes, but it was bright enough for Travis to see that the sofa's upholstery was slashed. Shredded foam padding spilled onto the floor. A wooden magazine rack had been hammered to pieces against the wall, gouging holes in the plasterboard. The TV screen had been smashed in with a floor lamp, which still protruded from the set. Books had been taken off the shelves, torn apart, and scattered across the living room. In spite of the breeze blowing in through the door, the stench seemed to be getting worse. Travis flicked the wall switch. A corner lamp came on. It did not shed much light, just enough to reveal more details of the rubble. "Looks like somebody went through here with a chainsaw and then a power mower," he thought. The house remained silent. Leaving the door open behind him, he took a couple of steps into the room, and the crumpled pages of the ruined books crunched crisply underfoot. He noticed dark, rusty stains on some of the paper and on the bone-white foam padding, and suddenly he stopped, realizing the stains were blood. A moment later, he spotted the corpse. It was that of a big man, lying on his side on the floor near the sofa, half covered by gore-smeared book pages, book boards, and dust jackets. Einstein's growling grew louder, meaner. Moving closer to the body, which was just a few feet from the dining room archway, Travis saw that it was his landlord, Ted Hockney. Beside him was his craftsman toolbox. Ted had a key to the house, and Travis had no objection to his entering at any time to make repairs. Lately, there'd been a number of repairs required, including a leaky faucet and broken dishwasher. Evidently, Ted had walked down the block from his own house and entered with the intention of fixing something. Now Ted was broken, too, and beyond repair. Because of the ripe stink, Travis first thought the man must have been killed at least a week ago. But on closer inspection, the corpse proved to be neither bloated with the gas of decomposition nor marked by any signs of decay. so it could not have been there for very long. Perhaps only a day, perhaps less. The hideous stench had two other sources. For one thing, the landlord had been disemboweled. Furthermore, his killer had apparently defecated and urinated on and around the body. Ted Hockney's eyes were gone. Travis felt sick, and not only because he had liked Ted. He would have been sickened by such insane violence regardless of who the dead man had been. A death like this left the victim no dignity whatsoever, and somehow diminished the entire human race. Einstein's low growling gave way to ugly snarling, punctuated with hard, sharp barks. With a nervous twitch and a sudden hammering of his heart, Travis turned from the corpse and saw that the retriever was facing into the nearby dining room. The shadows were deep in there because the drapes were drawn shut over both windows, and only a thin gray light passed through from the kitchen beyond. "Go, get out, leave," an inner voice told him. But he did not turn and run, because he had never run away from anything in his life. Well, all right, that was not quite true. He had virtually run away from life itself these past few years when he had let despair get the best of him. His descent into isolation had been the ultimate cowardice. However, that was behind him. He was a new man, transformed by Einstein and Nora, and he was not going to run again, damned if he was. Einstein went rigid. He arched his back, thrust his head down and forward, and barked so furiously that saliva flew from his mouth. Travis took a step toward the dining room arch. The retriever stayed at Travis's side, barking more viciously. Holding the revolver in front of him, trying to take confidence from the powerful weapon, Travis eased forward another step, treading cautiously in the treacherous rubble. He was only two or three steps from the archway. He squinted into the gloomy dining room. Einstein's barking resounded through the house until it seemed as if a whole pack of dogs must be loose in the place. Travis took one more step, then saw something move in the shadowy dining room. He froze. Nothing. Nothing moved. Had it been a phantom of the mind? Beyond the arch, layered shadows hung like gray and black crepe. He wasn't sure if he had seen movement or merely imagined it. "Back off, get out, now," the inner voice said. In defiance of it, Travis raised one foot, intending to step into the archway. The thing in the dining room moved again. This time there was no doubt of its presence, because it rushed out of the deepest darkness at the far side of that chamber, vaulted onto the dining room table, and came straight at Travis, emitting a blood-freezing shriek. He saw lantern eyes in the gloom, and a nearly man-sized figure that, in spite of the poor light, gave an impression of deformity. And the thing was coming off the table, straight at him. Einstein charged forward to engage it, but Travis tried to step back and gain an extra second in which to squeeze off a shot. As he pulled the trigger, he slipped on the ruined books that littered the floor and fell backward. The revolver roared, but Travis knew he had missed, had fired into the ceiling. For an instant, as Einstein scrambled toward the adversary, Travis saw the lantern-eyed thing more clearly. Saw it work alligator jaws and crack open an impossibly wide mouth in a lumpish face, revealing wickedly hooked teeth. "Einstein, no!" he shouted, for he knew the dog would be torn to pieces in any confrontation with this hellish creature. And he fired again, twice, wildly from his position on the floor. His cry and the shots not only brought Einstein to a halt, but gave the enemy second thoughts about going up against an armed man. The thing turned. It was quick, far quicker than a cat, and crossed the unlighted dining room to a kitchen doorway. For a moment, he saw it silhouetted in the murky light from the kitchen, and he had the impression of something that had never been meant to stand erect, but was standing erect anyway. Something with a misshapen head twice as large as it ought to have been. A hunched back, arms too long, and terminating in claws like the tines of a garden rake. He fired again, and came closer to the mark. The bullet tore out a chunk of the door frame. With a shriek, the beast disappeared into the kitchen. What in the name of God was it? Where had it come from? Had it really escaped from the same lab that had produced Einstein? But how had they made this monstrosity, and why? Why? He was a well-read man. In fact, For the last few years, most of his time was devoted to books, so possibilities began to occur to him. Recombinant DNA research was foremost among them. Einstein stood in the middle of the dining room, barking, facing the doorway where the thing had vanished. Lurching to his feet in the living room, Travis called the dog back to his side, and Einstein returned quickly, eagerly. He shushed the dog, listened intently. He heard Nora frantically calling his name from the yard out front, but he heard nothing in the kitchen. For Nora's benefit, he shouted, "I'm okay! I'm all right! Stay out there!" Einstein was shivering. Travis could hear the loud, two-part thudding of his own heart, and he could almost hear the sweat trickling down his face and down the small of his back. But he could hear nothing whatsoever to pinpoint that escapee from a nightmare. He did not think it had gone out the back door into the rear yard. For one thing, he figured the creature did not want to be seen by a lot of people, and therefore only went outside at night, traveled exclusively in the dark, when it could slip even into a fair-sized town like Santa Barbara without being spotted. The day was still light enough to make the thing leery of the outdoors. Furthermore, Travis could sense its presence nearby, the way he might sense that someone was staring at him behind his back. The way he might sense an oncoming thunderstorm on a humid day with a lowering sky. It was out there all right, waiting in the kitchen, ready and waiting. Cautiously, Travis returned to the archway and stepped into the half-dark dining room. Einstein stayed close at his side, neither whining nor growling nor barking. The dog seemed to realize that Travis needed complete silence in order to hear any sound the beast might make. Travis took two more steps. Ahead through the kitchen door, he could see a corner of the table, the sink, part of a counter, half of the dishwasher. The setting sun was at the other end of the house, and the light in the kitchen was dim, gray, so their adversary would not cast a revealing shadow. It might be waiting on either side of the door, or it might have climbed onto the counters from which it could launch itself down at him when he entered the room. Trying to trick the creature, hoping that it would react without hesitation to the first sign of movement in the doorway, Travis tucked the revolver under his belt, quietly picked up one of the dining room chairs, eased to within 6 feet of the kitchen, and pitched the chair through the open door. He snatched the revolver out of his waistband, as the chair sailed into the kitchen, assumed a shooter's stance. The chair crashed into the formica-topped table, clattered to the floor, and banged against the dishwasher. The lantern-eyed enemy did not go for it. Nothing moved. When the chair finished tumbling, the kitchen was again marked by a hushed expectancy. Einstein was making a curious sound, a quiet, shuddery huffing, and after a moment Travis realized the noise was a result of the dog's uncontrollable shivering. No question about it. The intruder in the kitchen was the very thing that had pursued them through the woods more than 3 months ago. During the intervening weeks, it had made its way north, probably traveling mostly in the wildlands to the east of the developed part of the state, relentlessly tracking the dog by some means that Travis could not understand, and for reasons he could not even guess. In response to the chair he had thrown, a large white enameled canister crashed to the floor just beyond the kitchen doorway, and Travis jumped back in surprise, squeezing off a wild shot before he realized he was only being taunted. The lid flew off the container when it hit the floor, and flour spilled across the tile. Silence again. By responding to Travis's taunt with one of its own, the intruder had displayed unnerving intelligence. Abruptly, Travis realized that, coming from the same research lab as Einstein, and being a product of related experiments, the creature might be as smart as the retriever, which would explain Einstein's fear of it. If Travis had not already accommodated himself to the idea of a dog with human-like intelligence, he might have been unable to credit this beast with more than mere animal cleverness. However, events of the past few months had primed him to accept, and quickly adapt to, almost anything. Silence. Only one round left in the gun. Deep silence. He had been so startled by the flour canister that he had not noticed from which side of the doorway it had been flung, and it had fallen in such a fashion that he could not deduce the position of the creature that had hurled it. He still did not know if the intruder was to the left or right of the doorway. He was not sure he any longer cared where it was. Even with the .357 in hand, he did not think he would be wise to enter the kitchen. Not if the damn thing was as smart as a man. It would be like doing battle with an intelligent buzzsaw, for Christ's sake. The light in the east-facing kitchen was dwindling, almost gone. In the dining room, where Travis and Einstein stood, the darkness was deepening. Even behind them, in spite of the open front door and window and the corner lamp, the living room was filling with shadows. In the kitchen, the intruder hissed loudly, a sound like escaping gas, which was immediately followed by a click, click, click that might have been made by sharply clawed feet or hands tapping against a hard surface. Travis had caught Einstein's tremors. He felt as if he were a fly on the edge of a spider's web, about to step into a trap. He remembered Ted Hockney's bitten, bloodied, eyeless face. Click, click. In anti-terrorist training, he had been taught how to stalk men, and he'd been good at it. But the problem here was that the yellow-eyed intruder was maybe as smart as a man, but could not be counted on to think like a man. So Travis had no way of knowing what it might do next, how it might respond to any initiative he made. Therefore, he could never outthink it, and by its alien nature, the creature had a perpetual and deadly advantage of surprise. Click. Travis quietly took a step back from the open kitchen door, then another step, treading with exaggerated care, not wanting the thing to discover that he was retreating because only God knew what it might do if it knew he was slipping out of its reach. Einstein padded silently into the living room, now equally eager to put distance between himself and the intruder. When he reached Ted Hockney's corpse, Travis glanced away from the dining room, searching for the least littered route to the front door, and he saw Nora standing by the armchair. Frightened by the gunfire, she had gotten a butcher's knife from the kitchenette in the airstream and had come to see if he needed help. He was impressed by her courage, but horrified to see her there in the glow of the corner lamp. Suddenly it seemed as if his nightmares of losing both Einstein and Nora were on the verge of coming true. The Cornell curse again. Because now they were both inside the house, both vulnerable, both possibly within striking distance of the thing in the kitchen. She started to speak. Travis shook his head and raised one hand to his mouth. Silenced, she bit her lip and glanced from him to the dead man on the floor. As Travis quietly stepped through the rubble, he was stricken by a feeling that the intruder had gone out the back of the house and was coming around the side, heading for the front door, risking being seen by neighbors in the gloom of twilight, intending to enter behind them, swift and fast. Nora was standing between Travis and the front door, so he would not have a clear shot at the creature if it came that way. Hell, it would be all over Nora 1 second after it reached the door. Trying not to panic, trying not to think of Hockney's eyeless face, Travis moved more quickly across the living room, risking the crackle of some debris underfoot, hoping those small noises would not carry to the kitchen if the intruder was still out there. Reaching Nora, he took her by the arm and propelled her toward the front door, out onto the stoop and down the stairs, looking left and right, half expecting to see the living nightmare rushing at them. But it was nowhere in sight. The gunshots and Nora's shouting had drawn neighbors as far as their front doors all along the street. A few had even come outside onto porches and lawns. Somebody surely would have called the cops. Because of Einstein's status as a much-wanted fugitive, the police seemed almost as grave a danger as the yellow-eyed thing in the house. The three of them piled into the pickup. Nora locked her door, and Travis locked his. He started the engine and backed the truck and the airstream out of the driveway into the street. He was aware of people staring. The twilight was going to be short-lived, as it always was near the ocean. Already the sunless sky was blackish in the east, purple overhead, and a steadily darkening blood red in the west. Travis was grateful for the oncoming cover of nightfall, although he knew the yellow-eyed creature would be sharing it with them. He drove past the gaping neighbors, none of whom he had ever met during his years of self-imposed solitude, and he turned at the first corner. Nora held Einstein tightly, and Travis drove as fast as he dared. The trailer rocked and swayed behind them when he took the next couple of corners at too great a speed. "What happened in there?" she asked. "It killed Hockney earlier today or yesterday." "It?" "And it was waiting for us to come home." "It?" she repeated. Einstein mewled. Travis said, "I'll have to explain later." He wondered if he could explain. No description he gave of the intruder would do it justice. He did not possess the words necessary to convey the degree of its strangeness. They had gone no more than 8 blocks when they heard sirens in the neighborhood that they had just left. Travis drove another 4 blocks and parked in the empty lot of a high school. "What now?" Nora asked. "We abandon the trailer and the truck," he said. "They'll be looking for both." He put the revolver in her purse, and she insisted on slipping the butcher's knife in there too, rather than leave it behind. They got out of the pickup, and in the descending night, walked past the side of the school, across an athletic field, through a gate and a chain-link fence, and onto a residential street lined with mature trees. With nightfall, the breeze became a blustery wind, warm and parched. It blew a few dry leaves at them and harried dust ghosts along the pavement. Travis knew they were too conspicuous even without the trailer and truck. The neighbors would be telling the police to look for a man, woman, and golden retriever. Not the most common trio. They would be wanted for questioning in the death of Ted Hockney, so the search for them would not be perfunctory. They had to get out of sight quickly. He had no friends with whom they could take refuge. After Paula died, he had withdrawn from his few friends, and he hadn't maintained relationships with any of the real estate agents who had once worked for him. Nora had no friends either, thanks to Violet Devon. The houses they passed, most with warm lights in the windows, seemed to mock them with unattainable sanctuary. Part 8. Garrison Dilworth lived on the border between Santa Barbara and Montecito, on a lushly landscaped half-acre, in a stately Tudor home that did not mesh well with the California flora, but which perfectly complemented the attorney. When he answered the door, he was wearing black loafers, gray slacks, a navy blue sports jacket, a white knit shirt, and half-lens tortoiseshell reading glasses over which he peered at them in surprise, but fortunately not with displeasure. "Well, hello there, newlyweds." "Are you alone?" Travis asked, as he and Nora and Einstein stepped into a large foyer floored with marble. "Alone, yes." On the way over, Nora had told Travis that the attorney's wife had passed away 3 years ago, and that he was now looked after by a housekeeper named Gladys Murphy. "Mrs. Murphy?" Travis asked. "She's gone home for the day," the attorney said, closing the door behind them. "You look distraught. What on earth's wrong?"
"We need help," Nora said.
"But," Travis warned, "anyone who helps us may be putting himself in jeopardy with the law." Garrison raised his eyebrows. "What have you done? Judging by the solemn look of you, I'd say you've kidnapped the president."
"We've done nothing wrong," Nora assured him.
"Yes, we have," Travis disagreed, "and we're still doing it. We're harboring the dog." Puzzled, Garrison frowned down at the retriever. Einstein whined, looking suitably miserable and lovable. "And there's a dead man in my house," Travis said. Garrison's gaze shifted from the dog to Travis. "Dead man?"
"Travis didn't kill him,"
Nora said. Garrison looked at Einstein again.
"Neither did the dog," Travis said. "But I'll be wanted as a material witness. Something like that, sure as hell."
"Hmm," Garrison said. "Why don't we go into my study and get this straightened out?" He led them through an enormous and only half-lit living room, along a short hallway, into a den with rich teak paneling and a copper ceiling. The maroon leather armchairs and couch looked expensive and comfortable. The polished teak desk was massive, and a detailed model of a 5-master schooner, all sails rigged, stood on one corner. Nautical items, a ship's wheel, a brass sextant, a carved bullock's horn filled with tallow that held what appeared to be sail-making needles, 6 types of ship lanterns, a helmsman's bell, and sea charts were used as decoration. Travis saw photographs of a man and woman on various sailboats, and the man was Garrison. An open book and a half-finished glass of scotch were on a small table beside one of the armchairs. Evidently, the attorney had been relaxing here when they had rung the doorbell. Now he offered them a drink, and they both said they would have whatever he was having.
Leaving the couch for Travis and Nora, Einstein took the second armchair. He sat in it rather than curling up, as if prepared to participate in the discussion to come. At a corner wet bar, Garrison poured Chivas Regal on the rocks in two glasses. Although Nora was unaccustomed to whiskey, she startled Travis by downing her drink in two long swallows and asking for another. He decided that she had the right idea, so he followed suit and took his empty glass back to the bar while Garrison was refilling Nora's.
"I'd like to tell you everything and have your help," Travis said. "But you really must understand, you could be putting yourself on the wrong side of the law."
Recapping the Chivas, Garrison said, "You're talking as a layman now. As an attorney, I assure you the law isn't a line engraved in marble, immovable and unchangeable through the centuries. Rather, the law is like a string, fixed at both ends but with a great deal of play in it. Very loose, the line of the law. So you can stretch it this way or that, rearrange the arc of it so you are nearly always, short of blatant theft or cold-blooded murder, safely on the right side. That's a daunting thing to realize, but true. I've no fear that anything you tell me could land my bottom in a prison cell, Travis."
Half an hour later, Travis and Nora had told him everything about Einstein. For a man only a couple of months shy of his 71st birthday, the silver-haired attorney had a quick and open mind. He asked the right questions and did not scoff. When given a 10-minute demonstration of Einstein's uncanny abilities, he did not protest that it was all mere trickery and flummery. He accepted what he saw, and he readjusted his ideas of what was normal and possible in this world. He exhibited greater mental agility and flexibility than most men half his age. Holding Einstein on his lap in the big leather armchair, gently scratching the dog's ears, Garrison said, "If you go to the media, hold a press conference, blow the whole thing wide open, then we might be able to sue in court to allow you to keep custody of the dog."
"Do you really think that would work?" Nora asked.
"At best," Garrison admitted, "it's a 50-50 chance."
Travis shook his head. "No, we won't risk it."
"What have you in mind to do?" Garrison asked.
"Run," Travis said. "Stay on the move."
"And what will that accomplish?"
"It'll keep Einstein free."
The dog woofed in agreement.
"Free, but for how long?" Garrison asked.
Travis got up and paced, too agitated to sit still any longer.
"They won't stop looking," he admitted. "Not for a few years."
"Not ever,"
the attorney said.
"All right, it's going to be tough, but it's the only thing we can do. Damned if we'll let him have him. He has a dread of the lab. Besides, he more or less brought me back to life."
"And he saved me from Streck," Nora said.
"He brought us together," Travis said.
"Changed our lives.
Radically changed us.
Now he's as much a part of us as our own child would be," Travis said.
He felt a lump of emotion in his throat when he met the dog's grateful gaze.
"We fight for him just as he'd fight for us. We're family. We live together or we die together."
Stroking the retriever, Garrison said, "It won't only be the people from the lab looking for you, and not only the police."
"The other thing," Travis said, nodding.
Einstein shivered.
"There, there, easy now,"
Garrison said reassuringly, patting the dog.
To Travis, he said, "What do you think the creature is? I've heard your description of it, but that doesn't help much."
"Whatever it is," Travis said, "God didn't make it. Men made it. Which means it has to be a product of recombinant DNA research of some kind. God knows why. God knows what they thought they were doing, why they wanted to build something like that. But they did.
And it seems to have an uncanny ability to track you."
"To track Einstein," Nora said.
"So we'll keep moving," Travis said. "And we'll go a long way."
"That'll require money, but the banks don't open for more than 12 hours, Garrison said. "If you're going to run, something tells me you've got to head out tonight."
"Here's where we could use your help," Travis told him.
Nora opened her purse and withdrew two checkbooks, Travis's and her own.
"Garrison, what we'd like to do is write a check on Travis's account and one in mine, payable to you. He's only got $3,000 in his checking, but he has a large savings account at the same bank, and they're authorized to transfer funds to prevent overdrawing. My account's the same way. If we give you one of Travis's checks for $20,000, backdated so it appears to have been written before all this trouble, and one of mine for $20,000, you could deposit them into your account. As soon as they clear, you'd buy 8 cashier's checks for $5,000 apiece and send them to us." Travis said. The police will want me for questioning. But they'll know I didn't kill Ted Hockney because no man could have torn him apart like that. So they won't put a lock on my accounts.
The federal agencies are behind the research that produced Einstein and this creature, Garrison said. Then they'll be hot to get their hands on you. And they might freeze your accounts.
Maybe. But probably not right away. You're in the same town, so your bank should clear my check by Monday at the latest.
What'll you do for funds in the meantime, while you're waiting for me to send you the $40,000?
We've got some cash and traveler's checks left over from the honeymoon, Nora said.
And my credit cards, Travis added. They can track you by credit cards and traveler's checks.
I know, Travis said. So I'll use them in a town where we don't intend to stay, and we'll scoot out fast as we can.
When I've purchased the cashier's checks for $40,000, where do I send them?
We'll be in touch by phone, Travis said, returning to the couch and sitting at Nora's side. We'll work something out.
And the rest of your assets? And Nora's?
We'll worry about that later, Nora said.
Garrison frowned. Before you leave here, Travis, you can sign a letter giving me the right to represent you in any legal matters that may arise. If anyone does try to freeze your assets, or Nora's, I can beat them off, if at all possible, though I'll keep a low profile until they connect me with you.
Nora's funds are probably safe for a while. She and I haven't told anyone but you about the marriage. The neighbors will tell the police I left in the company of a woman, but they won't know who she is. Have you told anyone about us?
Just my secretary, Mrs. Ashcroft, but she's not a gossip.
All right, then, Travis said. I don't think the authorities will find out about the marriage license, so they might take quite a while to come up with Nora's name. But when they do, they'll discover you're her attorney. If they monitor my accounts for canceled checks in the hope of learning where I've gone, they'll know about the $20,000 I paid to you, and they'll come looking for you.
That doesn't give me the slightest pause, Garrison said.
Maybe not, Travis said. But as soon as they connect me to Nora, and both of us to you, they'll be watching you closely. As soon as that happens, then the next time we call, they'll have to tell us at once so we can hang up and break off all contact with you.
I understand perfectly, the attorney said.
Garrison, Nora said, you don't have to involve yourself in this. We're really asking too much of you.
Listen, my dear, I'm almost 71. I still enjoy my law practice, and I still go sailing. But in truth, I find life a bit on the dull side these days. This affair is just what I need to get my ancient blood flowing faster. Besides, I do believe you have an obligation to help keep Einstein free, not just for the reasons you mentioned, but because mankind has no right to employ its genius in the creation of another intelligent species, then treat it like property. If we've come so far that we can create as God creates, then we have to learn to act with the justice and mercy of God. In this case, justice and mercy require that Einstein remain free.
Einstein raised his head from the attorney's lap, gazed up admiringly, then nuzzled his cold nose under Garrison's chin. In the three-car garage, Garrison kept a new black Mercedes 560 SEL, an older white Mercedes 500 SEL with a pale blue interior, and a green Jeep that he used primarily to drive down to the marina where he kept his boat.
The white one used to belong to Francine, my wife, the attorney said as he led them to the car. I don't use it much anymore, but I keep it in working order, and I drive it often enough to prevent the tires from disintegrating. I should have gotten rid of it when Franny died. It was her car, after all. But she loved it so, her flashy white Mercedes. And I can remember the way she looked when she was behind the wheel. I'd like you to take it.
A $60,000 getaway car? Travis said, sliding one hand along the polished hood.
That's going on the run in style. No one would be looking for it, Garrison said. Even if they do eventually connect me with you two, they won't know I've given you one of my cars.
We can't accept something this expensive, Nora said.
Call it a loan, the attorney told her. When you're finished with it, when you've gotten another car, just park this one somewhere, a bus terminal, an airport, and give me a call to tell me where it is. I can send someone to collect it.
Einstein put his forepaws on the driver's door of the Mercedes and peered into the car through the side window. He glanced at Travis and Nora and woofed as if to say he thought they would be foolish if they turned down such an offer. Part 9. With Travis driving, they left Garrison Dilworth's house at 10:15 Wednesday night and took Route 101 north. By 12:30, they passed through San Luis Obispo, went by Paso Robles at 1 o'clock in the morning. They stopped for gasoline at a self-service station at 2 o'clock, an hour south of Salinas. Nora felt useless. She was not even able to spell Travis at the wheel because she did not know how to drive. To some extent, that was Violet Devon's fault, not Nora's. Just one more result of a lifetime of seclusion and oppression. Nonetheless, she felt utterly useless and was displeased with herself. But she was not going to remain helpless the rest of her life. Damn it, no. She was going to learn to drive and to handle firearms. Travis could teach her both skills. Given his background, he could also instruct her in the martial arts, judo or karate. He was a good teacher. He had certainly done a splendid job of teaching her the art of lovemaking. That thought made her smile, and slowly her highly self-critical mood abated. For the next 2.5 hours, as they drove north to Salinas and then on to San Jose, Nora dozed fitfully. When not sleeping, she took comfort in the empty miles they were putting behind them. On both sides of the highway, vast stretches of farmland seemed to roll on to infinity under the frost-pale light of the moon. When the moon set, they drove long stretches in unrelieved darkness before spotting an occasional light at a farm or a cluster of roadside businesses. The yellow-eyed thing had tracked Einstein from the Santa Ana foothills in Orange County to Santa Barbara, a distance of more than 125 air miles, Travis had said, and probably close to 300 miles on foot in the wilds, in 3 months. Not a fast pace. So if they went 300 air miles north from Santa Barbara before finding a place to hole up in the San Francisco Bay Area, maybe the stalker would not reach them for 7 or 8 months. Maybe it would never reach them. Over how great a distance could it sniff out Einstein? Surely, there were limits to its uncanny ability to track the dog. Surely. Part 10. At 11 o'clock Thursday morning, Lemuel Johnson stood in the master bedroom of the small house that Travis Cornell had rented in Santa Barbara. The dresser mirror had been smashed. The rest of the room had been trashed as well, as if the outsider had been driven into a jealous rage upon seeing that the dog lived in domestic comfort, while it was forced to roam the wildlands and live in comparatively primitive conditions. In the debris that covered the floor, Lem found 4 silver-framed photographs that had probably stood on the dresser or nightstands. The first was of Cornell and an attractive blonde. By now, Lem had learned enough about Cornell to know that the blonde at his side must be his late wife, Paula. Another photo, a black-and-white shot of a man and a woman, was old enough that Lem guessed the people smiling at the camera were Cornell's parents. The third was of a young boy, about 11 or 12, also black and white, also old, which might have been a shot of Travis Cornell himself, but which was more likely a picture of the brother who had died young. The last of the 4 photos was of 10 soldiers grouped on what appeared to be the wooden steps in front of a barracks, grinning at the camera. One of the 10 was Travis Cornell. And on a couple of their uniforms, Lem noticed the distinctive patch of Delta Force, the elite anti-terrorist corps. Uneasy about that last photograph, Lem put it on the dresser and headed back toward the living room, where Cliff was continuing to sift through blood-stained rubble. They were looking for something that would mean nothing to the police, but might be extremely meaningful to them. The NSA had been slow to pick up on the Santa Barbara killing, and Lem had not been alerted until almost 6 o'clock this morning. As a result, the press had already reported the grisly details of Ted Hockney's murder. They were enthusiastically disseminating wild speculations about what might have killed Hockney, focusing primarily on the theory that Cornell kept some kind of exotic and dangerous pet, perhaps a cheetah or a panther, and that the animal had attacked the unsuspecting landlord when he had let himself into the house. The TV cameras had lingered lovingly on the shredded and blood-spattered books. It was National Enquirer stuff, which did not surprise Lem, because he believed the line separating sensational tabloids like the Enquirer and the so-called legitimate press, especially electronic news media, was often thinner than most journalists cared to admit. He had already planned and put into operation a disinformation campaign to reinforce the press's wrong-headed hysteria about jungle cats on the loose. NSA paid informants would come forth, claiming to know Cornell, and would vouch that he did indeed keep a panther in the house in addition to the dog.
others who had never met Cornell would, in identifying themselves as his friends, sorrowfully report that they had urged him to have the panther defanged and declawed as it had reached maturity. Police would want to question Cornell and the unidentified woman regarding the panther and its current whereabouts. Lem was confident the press would be nicely deflected from all inquiries that might lead them closer to the truth. Of course, down in Orange County, Walt Gaines would hear about this murder, would make friendly inquiries with local authorities here, and would swiftly conclude that the outsider had tracked the dog this far north. Lem was relieved that he had Walt's cooperation. Entering the living room where Cliff Soames was at work, Lem said, "Find anything?" The young agent rose from the debris, dusted his hands together, and said, "Yeah, I put it on the dining room table." Lem followed him into the dining room, where a fat ring-binder notebook was the only item on the table. When he opened it and leafed through the contents, he saw photographs that had been cut from glossy magazines and taped to the left-hand pages. Opposite each photo, on the right-hand page, was the name of the pictured object printed in large block letters. Tree, house, car. "What do you make of it?" Cliff asked. Scowling, saying nothing, Lem continued to leaf through the book, knowing it was important, but at first unable to guess why. Then it hit him. "It's a primer, to teach reading." "Yeah," Cliff said. Lem saw that his assistant was smiling. "You think they must know the dog's intelligent, that it must have revealed its abilities to them, and so they decided to teach it to read?" "Looks that way," Cliff said, still smiling. "Good God, you think it's possible? Could it be taught to read?"
"Undoubtedly," Lem said. "In fact, teaching it to read was on Dr. Weatherby's schedule of experiments for this autumn."
Laughing softly, wonderingly, Cliff said, "I'll be damned."
"Before you get too much of a kick out of it," Lem said, "you better consider the situation. This guy knows the dog is amazingly smart. He might have succeeded in teaching it to read. So we have to figure he's worked out a means of communicating with it as well. He knows it's an experimental animal. He must know a lot of people are looking for it."
Cliff said, "He must know about the outsider, too, because the dog would have found a way of telling him."
"Yes. Yet knowing all of this, he hasn't chosen to go public. He could have sold the story to the highest bidder. But he didn't. Or if he's a crusading type, he could have called in the press and blasted the Pentagon for funding this kind of research."
"But he didn't," Cliff said, frowning.
"Which means, first and foremost, he's committed to the dog. Committed to keeping it for his own, and to preventing its recapture."
Nodding, Cliff said,
"Which makes sense if what we've heard about him is true. I mean, this guy lost his whole damn family when he was young. Lost his wife after less than a year, lost all his buddies in Delta Force, so he became a recluse, cut himself off from all his friends. Must have been lonely as hell. Then along comes the dog."
"Exactly," Lem said.
"And for a man with Delta Force training, staying undercover won't be difficult. And if we do find him, he'll know how to fight for the dog. Jesus, will he know how to fight?"
"We haven't confirmed the Delta Force rumor yet," Cliff said, hopefully.
"I have," Lem said, and he described the photograph he had seen in the wrecked bedroom.
Cliff sighed.
"We're in deep shit now."
"Up to our necks," Lem agreed.
Part 11. They had reached San Francisco at 6 o'clock Thursday morning, and by 6:30 had found a suitable motel, a sprawling facility that looked modern and clean. The place did not accept pets, but it was easy to sneak Einstein into the room. Although a small chance existed that an arrest warrant might have been issued for Travis, he checked into the motel using his ID. He'd no choice, because Nora possessed neither credit cards nor a driver's license. These days, desk clerks were willing to accept cash, but not without ID. The chain's computer demanded data on the guests. He did not, however, give the correct make or license number of his car, for he had parked out of sight of the office for the very purpose of keeping those details from the clerk. They paid for only one room and kept Einstein with them, because they were not going to need privacy for lovemaking. Exhausted, Travis barely managed to kiss Nora before falling into a deep sleep. He dreamed of things with yellow eyes, misshapen heads, and crocodile mouths full of shark's teeth. He woke 5 hours later, at 12:10 Thursday afternoon. Nora had gotten up before him, showered and dressed again in the only clothes she had.
Her hair was damp and clung alluringly to the nape of her neck. "The water's hot and forceful," she told him.
"So am I," he said, embracing her, kissing her. "Then you'd better cool off," she said, pulling away from him.
"Little ears are listening."